It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. It is moving into that season. We are well into that season that we call hurricane summer. In a normal year, we'd start seeing more hurricanes. I don't know what's going to happen this year. It'll be interesting. Hurricanes drive what happens along the Gulf Coast this time of year. And even inland, well inland, with rains. As we move into August and September, you start seeing fewer rains. You're going to get a little bit more rain along the Gulf Coast. That's great. You're going to need it. It's a hot time of year. September can be very dry. It can be very sere. Unless we get hurricanes or tropical storms. And I just don't know what's going to happen this year. El Nino does have an effect on those kinds of things. And so it's good to be aware of that. It's good to be aware that in all likelihood, you're going to see extended periods of dry weather. And that can be good. It can be bad. You're also going to see extended periods of heat this year. It's not going to break. I don't think we're going to get one of those surprise, oh, isn't that nice, September cool spells. At least not early in September. And that's going to affect how you grow your garden and what you do and when you put things out. But you need to get ready for that. And we'll talk about that this morning. For when the temperature is right to put them out, we'll talk about it. Talk about when to sow. But something else is happening this time of year. And I know it's happening because I'm getting calls about it. And I'm seeing it personally quite a lot. It's mating season for many snakes. And we're going to see a lot more of them in the garden. And as many of you move into areas that weren't formally developed, you're going to see a lot more snakes than maybe you're used to. It's, you know, they have all of these websites now that say the most snake infested places in Alabama. I don't know. They make it up somewhere. They get it out of the, you know, where you get stuff like that. It's kind of crazy because all of Alabama is, as we like to say, snake infested. I can assure you and the Southeast in general. I mean, it's one of the things we specialize in. We have a lot of diversity of snakes. And maybe your realtor doesn't like talking about that when you buy your house. Maybe the person who told you that Alabama was the best place to move for retirement didn't like telling you that, oh, gosh, Alabama's a snake-infested place. But maybe we ought to talk about that just a little bit, because let me tell you, Alabama's a snake-infested place. And by golly, that's one of the reasons I love living here. I grew up with snakes. And I used to play with them in the garden. I was 8 or 9 years old. And there was a little place with some rocks next to the house. It's actually concrete. And under that concrete, just old broken pieces of concrete, I could find hiding in the cool under the shade of some trees and sort of a half abandoned house next door, little earth snakes. Little bitty things, so cute. I mean, bigger than worms. not too much bigger. And I would play with them, put them in my pocket. We'd put them in boxes. We were probably pretty cruel to them because we were 8 years old. We didn't mean to be cruel. We just didn't think about it. And I'd put them in my pocket. I'd take them to church, you know, kind of an offering. I didn't put any in the plate when they passed it, if any of you remember that happening. I did. Some did get loose in the pews. I will say, those of you who go to church and you have those little cushioned pews, you should always look under the pews because you never know if someone like me dropped a snake under those cushions. But our fear of snakes is probably a little excessive. And I will tell you that I grew up scared to death of rattlesnakes. Just scared, so scared of rattlesnakes that even though I played with the little ones and even though some medium-sized ones, when I saw a rattlesnake, I could not speak. I couldn't speak. But it's the way I was taught. And one day I came over a mountain, finally, when I was, maybe 18 years old. That's how long you have to live with this kind of fear. And it was a spring day. And that mountainside was heating up. And I thought, if I ever see a snake, I'm going to see it right now. And right there below my foot. I mean, just 5-6 feet away was a big timber rattler. One of the larger ones I've seen. 4.5-5 feet easily. And I just sat down on a rock next to it. And I sat there for 30 minutes, 40 minutes, we were testing each other's patience a bit, but neither one of us really moved. I think I said a few words. And I stood up and left, and I realized the last thing a rattlesnake ever wanted to do was put its mouth on a nasty human. And I was over it. And since then, I've encountered rattlesnakes in every way possible. And we'll talk about that. It's kind of interesting. You just have to try hard to make them bite. And it happens in Alabama. We've got records of it. We know that a huge percentage of records of fatal snake bites in Alabama always involve a church service. People didn't bring them in their pockets. They brought them in big bags, and they held them up and said, I'm not going to be bitten by this snake because I'm so holy. And it's an interesting thought, interesting idea. We have church services like that even now. People get bit, they die. Doesn't prove they're not holy. Just proves they're not thinking well. And that's the kind of situations. Oh, there was another situation in Calhoun County. I remember this, where two guys got drunk and just found a rattlesnake and decided to start pitching it back and forth. You can imagine that didn't go well. My dog got bit. But dogs, you know, they pester the stew out of a rattlesnake. So we're going to talk a little bit about snakes today. Just because I know you're going to encounter them, because a lot of other people have called me to say, gosh, I haven't seen snakes all year. And suddenly I saw two snakes, one in my garden and one over here. And I couldn't. And there it is. And boom, it's going to happen. And there was a famous incident in Georgia recently where they closed the school down because someone saw what is apparently a harmless brown snake in the yard, which is mistakenly called ground rattler. It's a long story, you know, when you get into all of the misunderstandings about snakes. So we're going to talk a little bit about snakes. I guess we need to talk about snakes in some kind of religious sense, too, because, boy, our reaction to snakes is kind of a weird religion. We're going to be back.
How long? Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-ridin' that Tennessee stud.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 1065.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Somebody asked me, did I go to church in Op, Alabama? Well, no. You've got to know that snake handling is common across the state. I never took a poisonous snake to church. And I never handled one there. And I guess I did it to prove things, like other people who take poisonous snakes to church. I guess I was proving that I wasn't scared of snakes, right? There it is. But I was wise enough not to take the poisonous snake to church and handle it and hold it over my head and say, oh, I'm going to be protected because I'm so holy, because I don't know, some of you may be, but I ain't that holy. I'm not holy enough to start playing with a rattlesnake that way. On the other hand, rattlesnakes are pretty calm. They're pretty, I mean, you just have to try really hard. We're going to talk a little bit more about snakes this morning and how to distinguish them, and talking about what you've got in your garden. So if you've encountered a snake in your garden, you feel free to call me. And let's talk about it. Because in all likelihood, it's a harmless snake. It's a snake that's not going to bite you and have venom. And some snakes that do bite you don't have venom. They're going to bite you only because you're pestering the stew out of them. Most snakes are just going to smear you with a kind of a musk, which has an interesting smell. If you haven't tried that, you should try it sometime with something like brown snakes or rat snakes. But we should learn to distinguish them. So we're going to try to do that this morning. We got some questions. We got a lot of things to do, though, because it is hurricane summer. And hurricane summer means we got a lot to do in the garden. We got a lot to do. I will tell you that I am delaying planting things in the garden right now because we have got extreme heat coming up. Now, the things I'm delaying planting, marigolds will be fine. A lot of flowers will be fine. But the stuff that really loves cool weather, like cabbages, broccoli, oh, probably cauliflower, probably parsley, certainly fennel, a lot of mustards. Gonna have problems this time of year anyway. Even Swiss chard. I don't think there's any need right now to put them out in the garden anywhere in Alabama because the heat is going to be so intense that you're going to have problems. However, I will say that you can go ahead right now and sow your radishes. Radishes are so incredible. I mean, just sow them right in the garden. They will come up in this heat as long as you keep them moist. You can throw a little bit of a shade cloth over them. We can talk about that. Or just shade them with adjacent plants if you like, just to keep the soil. But they are tough, and they'll come right on through. It's probably not too early to plant beets as well directly in the garden. It's probably better to plant the beets directly. You may have a little bit of a problem with insects, but they're going to be pretty tough. Beets will come up. And keep that soil just a little bit cool over the beets. And then we'll talk about several ways of doing that. So it's a busy time, and we need to talk about that. And right now, B-Dark is asking me, all right, what am I going to do with all these plants you told me to start? So we're going to see what she's got. Looks like she's got a lot of what could be collards or kale. All the leaves on those are a bit similar when they come up. Because they're all related. Collard, amazing. Collards, kale, broccoli. cabbages, kohlrabi. There's a whole suite of plants that are basically old European and Asian adaptations of wild mustards. Wild brassicas. Which is a type of mustard, but that's okay. And they're very similar. Most of them are very similar in their requirements, and also similar in their disease susceptibility and in their bug susceptibility. And I think for most of them, it's just a little too early. There's a couple that'll go out. Radishes will tolerate it. Beets, different group. Not a brassica, not related to broccoli. It seems to do okay when you plant it in heat, as long as it can mature in cooler weather. We can talk about that. You got to aspire to beets. They can be a little tough. But I'm just going to hold on to them, and we're going to talk a little bit more as the morning goes on about what to do about holding on to those plants, because the heat of midday can be very stressful. However, they need sunlight. So I'm just going to give you a quick tip. Put them out in the morning in full sun, early in the morning. Get them as much full sun as you can early in the day. They'll be tolerant. If you want to keep them out until lunch, just give them a little spritz about 10 or 11 o'clock if you have time. But try to bring them in around lunchtime, or find someone who will bring them in for you, or put them in a place where they're going to get plenty of morning sun, because the sun is coming down, is low and comes down underneath them and gets plenty of sun then. And then give them a little shade at midday. You can set something up when the sun is at its height, kind of figure out where your sun is, and then give them protection through the afternoon. That's one way to do it. And then I'll tell you another trick. A lot of plants will tolerate the high heat. They're not going to tolerate the direct sun. They're going to wilt if you do that in direct sun in the afternoon now, particularly with those brassicas and those kinds of winter plants that like cool temperatures. But don't let them get too much sun in the afternoon, and then bring them in at night. It makes a ton of difference, and that's not hard to do. And you're living in a conditioned space more than likely at night. Make sure that they're in that conditioned space with you. Doesn't have to be super cool. Just a little bit cooler so that they're not working so hard at night. Makes a big difference. Makes a big difference. There is a ton of transpiration that goes on at night when you leave them outside. And it stays hot just a little too long at night. And they can't, see, if you think about it, they're not able to operate at night. They're not able to photosynthesize at night. They're not able to grab sunlight at night. And that's the fuel that plants use to grow. They don't use, nitrogen's grease. It's just a little bit of stuff that keeps the wheels turning. The wheels are about photosynthesis. And that's what makes these plants chug along, but they can't do photosynthesis at night. They can't get any sunlight at night. And so they end up just breathing themselves to death, because they're still having to breathe. Their respiration is not designed to deal with the high night temperatures. And so they exhaust their resources that they get during the day. Bring them inside at night. It makes a difference. It can make a difference, keeping them just a little bit cooler at night. I bring mine in at lunch if I'm around, or I find someone who can bring them inside for lunch. You know, I've thought about, this is not such a bad idea. Let's say you work in an office at lunch. You know, people have plants on their windowsills, right? At the office. You ever thought about doing that? It's probably possible. Well, people think you're weird. Oh, you are weird. I mean, you're listening to this show, aren't you? There you are. So, think about that. Let's see. Is that helping there with B-Dark? It looks like B-Dark's got a good setup. It looks like she's getting, are you getting full morning sun and then a little bit of shade? It kind of looks like you are late in the day. Look for that eastern look for that eastern sunlight where you're just getting full eastern sunlight, if possible. Full morning sun, as long as you possibly can, even if it's on a porch. And then at midday, the porch magically shades your plants.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-riding that Tennessee stud.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, so we got some folks who really want to know a little bit more about fall gardening, and that's where we're going to go. I want to stop briefly. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But I did want to answer a question. Who asked that question? Hold on just a second. Daryl over in Grand Bay, is this elderberry that is growing all over the south end of the county? And he sent me a picture. And indeed, it is elderberry. You can tell by the berries, which are nice and dark black now. You can also tell by those leaves. This is a good lesson in leaves. Elderberry has what we call compound leaves. And if you look, each leaf is actually composed of many leaflets. And they, when the leaf falls, all of those leaflets fall on the stem. It's not like each of those leaves fall off. The whole leaf falls off all the way back to the stem. You see how it's attached to the stem? That's called a compound leaf. Black walnuts have compound leaves. Pecans have compound leaves. So it's a quick, easy way to identify elderberries. They have compound leaves. So even if they're not in flower, even if they're not in fruit, if you see those compound leaves, that's a clue that it could be, it could be walnut, it could be elderberry, it could be pecan, it could be another type of hickory, it could be an ash. But you'll learn to see other things that make it elderberry pretty easily. It's going to be shrubby and a little bit of a thicket with those compound leaves. Elderberries. So that's what you got, is an elderberry. If that doesn't make sense about the compound leaf, you call me. Look at how it's attached to the stem. You see? See all those little leaflets on one stem that's kind of greenish and looks very fresh and green? That's the petiole. That's the things that the leaves are attached to. But the leaf itself, the leaflets are attached to that, but the leaf itself is attached to the stem, and the whole thing falls off. Nine leaves at once, as it looks like in your plants. And number of leaflets vary. But there it is. That's elderberry. A cool plant. And it does. It is just grows all over the place. And it has amazing fruit. It's good for processing. It's something that we ignore. I can't understand why exactly, except that it does take a little bit of processing. But they're great plants. They're wonderful plants. They can drive you crazy if you have a small garden and you got a few and you can't get rid of them because they're gonna come up, but boy, they're a great resource. Elderberries, that's what you got. I think we underestimate how important elderberries are. Carrots are in the round pots. Okay. And I got it set up to where I put them in the morning sun till about noon, then I move them in under the roof with a fan. That's good. So V-Dark's playing her pots right. She's got her pots in just the right place. She's got carrots in the round pots. I've never grown carrots that way. They do have a deep taproot. And so you're going to have to get those. I think you've probably done okay. I think you're going to have to find a place in the garden for those as soon as possible. Because carrots have deep roots. And B-Dark, this is a wonderful experiment. I'm glad you did it. maybe it provides some hints for all of us. I don't know how well they'll transfer to the garden. Maybe quite well. And maybe you'll do better than I do with carrots, because I'm always having problems with carrots. But you got those carrots to germinate. That's a great thing. Get them in the garden as soon as possible. Shade them pretty good. They're amazingly shade tolerant, as it seems. I've had them under, but just build a little lattice of twigs and other things over the top just to keep them nice and shaded. You're going to have to keep them well watered, but go ahead and put those in the garden. Here's another thing I would suggest. There's not really a good reason to try to divide those plants. So just take that pot as best you can, lift the carrots out, put them all in a clump, dig a hole for the whole clump, put the whole clump in there, and let them all grow up. You can thin them later and see how that does. That's what I would suggest. But I think because carrots have such deep roots, you know, that's what you're eating is them roots. But you probably ought to go ahead and get them planted before they'll get stunted in the pot, and you won't get good roots. See what I'm saying? So go ahead and plant those. I think the hard part on carrots is getting them started. All right. So Drew's asking, so look, I want to get started. This is my first year. And I want to get started putting out these winter vegetables. I don't think you're too late. You're great on a lot of things. I think this is the great week to start broccoli, to start cabbages, to start collards, to start kale. I wouldn't mess with mustards inside just yet. You could try it. You could go for some really giant mustards and try them inside. It might be a good idea. All of these things can be started inside. I'm missing something, I suspect, and I'm going to be ashamed for missing it, but a lot of those things can be started inside. I miss cabbage. Cabbage, broccoli, collards, kale. That got chard. I love chard. It's great. You can start fennel inside as well. So you've got all these different things, and there's a lot of different kind of broccolis out there, and it's kind of nice to know. I mean, some broccolis have more cold hardiness, and they're not as good in the heat. Some broccolis produce more quickly, and they're a little more tolerant of heat. Here's some that I've grown. Gemini, if you can find them, Gemini hybrids, tend to produce very quickly, and they do well in fall, and they do okay through the winter. I'm kind of surprised. They're good. They're not the best. Marathon has done really well for me through the winters. These are both hybrid broccolis. Marathon. It is not as tolerant of the heat. It takes a longer time to produce, but particularly along the Gulf Coast, those broccolis are going to do great through the winter. They're going to do great through the winter. That's two of them. I'm trying some others, and I'll let you know. Rasmus, I think, is one that I'm trying this year. Waltham, which hates the heat, just absolutely hates the heat, but it is very cold tolerant. So I'm giving it a. So anyway, it's a lot of different kinds of broccoli, a lot of different cabbages. Here's what I would do with cabbage, and I would go ahead and start some now. Charleston, Wakefield is cabbage is a good one that seems a little more heat tolerant and is pretty cold tolerant as well. And it's okay to start that one, and it takes a little longer. There are a lot of hybrid cabbages like, Katarina, which has done well for me. You could start it a little later because it basically produces a head in about 45 days. And so you can start it, maybe mid-September. But some of the other cabbages you want to start now. Start them inside in containers. I use cloth bags for a lot of reasons because I don't know how long I'm going to have to hold them. And it helps to keep those roots pruned. But B-Dark's got hers in these beautiful little plastic containers, and they're pretty spacious. She sowed a lot of seeds in each one, which I think is an okay thing to do. You'll have to go back through and thin them. But that gives you a little bit of assurance that some of them make it. Either way, and you can start them inside because the temperature inside is going to be just fine. They don't need sunlight to get the seeds started, right? So all is just start them inside while it's still cool. They'll be fine. And then you won't have to keep them watered as much. There is a problem of overwatering them inside, as a matter of fact. So don't, you get them kind of mist them. And it's not, the whole seedling tray doesn't need to be super wet because it's just, you're trying to get those seeds to germinate. And then once they germinate, then you can set the seedling tray and water it from the bottom. Just put it in a, gosh, this would drive your spouse crazy. I put mine in a baking sheet. Don't say I ever do that. But you put them in a baking sheet and the water, and you just bottom water them. That's one way to do it. Got little sides, you know what I'm saying? Doesn't need to be too deep. Let them water from the bottom. And then, but as soon as that green emerges, you want to give them some sunlight. So you're going to put them outside in the morning, just like I say. Or you're going to find a window that faces east. That might be great. Or even west. That's fine too. Or south. The problem with south is that southeast would be ideal. But the problem with just pure south right now in a window is that you have to, the sunlight may not come through there because it's still so high overhead. It'll decline a little more as the fall goes on, and you'll get some sunlight through the south window. But right now you're not getting a lot of sunlight through south windows. It's east and west windows. You're probably getting your best light. You might look for that and put them there and let them grow there. But putting them out in the morning is good. What kind of soil do you need? Just don't use garden soil for whatever you do. I just use pure pine bark. Beach piece no bigger than my fingernail. I buy a big load of it, and I use it for years, honestly. It's probably, I'm still working from a pile that I bought 5 years ago, 6 years ago. You can put it in a big garbage can. Oliver down at Flowerwood, and I'm sorry, not Chew, sorry about that, Oliver, down at what's Oliver's place name? I'm so sorry, I forgot the name. But there are several places you can buy soil mixed at various nurseries, and that's okay too. And it's mostly pine bark. Some of it will have fertilizer in it, some of it doesn't. The general rule is, if you buy it commercially, don't use fertilizer because there's probably already fertilizer in it, and probably more fertilizer than you actually need. So don't fertilize. Just put them in there with good potting mix, not garden soil, not even a bag of stuff designed to be garden soil, but good quality potting mix. And really, a good quality potting mix, in my definition, is this. It's got at least 70% pine bark in it. And you can look on the label on most of those mixes and see that. If it's got much less, it's probably going to be too soupy, too wet for starting. So you start them in pots with this kind of stuff, and you don't worry about fertilizer. You just worry about getting sunlight and keeping them cool. Does that help? You asked me more questions there, Keith, and let me know if I didn't answer all your questions. Let's see. In addition to Daryl's elderberry, the Calicarpa crop looks good in Irvington this year. Beautiful color contrast. Good show. Yeah, Calicarpa beauty berry is another great one that grows pretty wide, far and wide in Alabama. We'll be back. Have you ever?
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Big loss. Shore Acres closed, and I'm so sorry. Yeah, it was a great place to buy soil, great place to buy plants. It's a great resource for South Alabama. What a great family, the Washingtons. Boy, I don't know the story, but it's hard. It's getting harder to, and this is just a reminder. I have to remind you of this a lot. It's very important. I hope you're hearing me. We are going to have to take growing plants in our own hands. And if you, or we're going to be stuck. We're going to be stuck with trying to pretend like we can grow what Boston grows. You're not, we talk about plants that, the plants that grow well in our garden are not widely available anymore. We're going to have to grow them ourselves. And what does that mean? You individually? No, I don't think you're going to be set up for a lot of things. I think you can start by growing a fall garden, just like we've been talking about. And it's a very easy thing to do. And it just gives you a sense of what it takes to grow a garden. And I just by starting a few plants inside. But for getting a lot of plants, we're going to need to be able to grow things ourselves. And ourselves means collectively, together as a group. How do we do that? How do we organize to do that? How do we organize like a cooperative, which is what it's going to take, I promise you. How do we organize like a cooperative to take over some of the roles that people like Martin Vandergeesen used to play? And Bobby Green, you may not know these names, but they're the reason you had such a great assortment of azaleas and other plants for your garden. They're the reason you had such a great assortment of camellias and other plants for your garden. And Oliver Washington, who was great at growing a ton of annuals, and a lot of annuals that did really well for us. But what's happened is Walmart and Home Depot and these other guys, they're not growing for our market. They're not. They're just not. They're growing for a larger market. And even Bonnie's is not growing for our market with vegetables and other things. You can't get the best quality plants, the best adapted plants, let me put it that way, for our gardens by going to Bonnie's. We're going to have to grow them ourselves. And you're just going to have to work on that. And I think that means getting together, buying local as much as possible, encouraging your local nurseries. And buying local does not mean going to Walmart, folks. Buying local means, does not mean going to Home Depot, does not mean going to Lowe's. It means going to locally owned retailers. That's one way. And that's pretty important. And then you need to encourage them, and you need to show that you're going to be there to buy the plants that they produce and that they stick their necks out for. But even then, you're probably not going to get a lot of retailers who can take the risk of growing out a wide variety of plants. And that's where your local botanical gardens comes in handy. It's not just handy, it's imperative for your gardening. I'm just telling you, folks. With people like Oliver Washington going, until we can build a cooperative around local botanical gardens throughout the state, we're in trouble. We're in trouble. I will say that there is a, you know, there's some, Petals from the Past is a great model for how to do a nursery. They do things very well. They have a wide variety of plants. They're growing many of them out themselves, which is unusual. And they're up in Birmingham. That's way too far. But how do you, even then, I think the Birmingham Botanical Gardens plays a huge role in making sure that good plants are available for gardeners. I'm just telling you, I just can't say this enough. We think of gardening as a private affair, and that's okay because we can just go to the Home Depot and Walmart and keep it. But no, that's not going to work. We're going to have to be cooperative, and we're going to have to all work together. Find your own cooperative. build your own cooperative if you like. It's a lot of trouble. Or you try to support a regional cooperative built around a nonprofit that can afford to do this and to help you and that can bring together experts and advice. Support your local botanical garden. Support your local retail, locally owned retail, and your local botanical gardens. You're going to have to do both. And I really encourage you to do that. It's very important. Sorry, that digression. B-Dark said, B-Dark, still working on our watermelons. Yeah, watermelons can be a little tough, and they're getting a blossom end rot, which often happens with watermelons due to insufficient pollination. Sometimes watering differences can make a big difference. The variety can make a big difference. All those things. Calcium can make a bit of difference, even with watermelons. Even though they like kind of sandy soils and they do well, you might need to add a little bit of calcium. But that looks like it kind of got poor pollination there towards the end, too. Yeah, it's a tough one. B-Dark asked about, do I have to plant my carrots right away? Look, I think B-Dark has a great system here. I think it's potentially a great system. And I don't know why I haven't thought about it before. It's a little awkward. It's a little awkward to trial it. But getting those carrots started in containers and then planting the whole container might be a good way to deal with carrots. You'll have to thin some of them, and I can see there's some strategy that has to go into it. But I'm kind of liking the idea because those carrots can be very vulnerable when they're young. So how do you do that? I don't know. I'm experimenting and in my head, and B-Dark is experimenting in real life. She said, do I have to plant my carrots right away? The problem with putting them in containers is that carrots have roots, and you are eating the roots, and you want those roots, unless they're really short roots, they're gonna hit the bottom of that container, and they're gonna go. They're gonna J-root. They're gonna get all twisted around. You're not gonna have your carrots are not gonna be as nice. So you don't want to leave them in the container too long. How long is that? It's hard to say. But they're in that kind of soil, in good potting soil, in a container. They're going to hit the bottom of the pot very fast. So I recommend a week or two after they germinate, maybe 2 weeks at most, before I put them in the garden. And I'd go ahead and put them in the garden, and I think they're going to do fine, and you can shade them there. And you'll have a little bit of bug predation probably in the garden, a little more than you had. And that's okay because you've got them kind of thick there, and that's all right. But getting them to germinate is a tough thing this time of year, and you've succeeded. That's one of the tougher things. and ants are carrying off the seeds or whatever it is in the soil that carries, I think it's probably ants, and cutworms are hitting the little ones. There's all kind of problems for those little first emerging seedlings, but you're getting them to the first stage. And certainly by the time you see the first true leaves, they'll be ferny, not like what you've got there. You certainly ought to put them in the garden. But I want to get them in. Now, here's what I would experiment. Here's what I asked B-Dark to do. I said, look, take half of those, put them in at the end of this week. She started them last week. They've germinated pretty quickly. Just a few days, and they're germinating. That's great. I'm shocked that the carrots germinated that quickly. All right, we'll be back after this break.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. What did we leave undone? I hope you're, you know, I hope I'm giving you enough information and to get you started sowing seeds this time of year. It's a great start. And you can do it for flowers. You can do it for marigolds. You can do it for lots of things. It's not too late. Petunias is another good thing to start this time of year. Yes, petunias. Actually, this may be the best time for petunias. You start those in spring, and you have all kind of problems. A little hard to start petunias, but this is a good time to put them out. But petunias, it's probably not too late to even start snapdragons. And I would start snapdragons now if you can find some good snap. I love snapdragons. They're really cool. I mean, you know, it's like me and the little snakes. They just are fun to play with, those little snappy dragons. Get the old-fashioned kind. Don't get the newfangled kind. Get the old-fashioned kind so you can play with them. If you don't know what I mean by playing with snapdragons, you ain't lived. All that's good. We mentioned a whole bunch of greens that you can plant this time of year, all in this brassica group, which includes some of that cabbage and cauliflower and kale and broccoli, collards. They're all pretty closely related, and this is a good time to start those. They can be a little slow to get started. Mustards are a little different. They'll come up more quickly. There's some things you can plant directly in the garden. But if you don't know, if you've got any questions about the things we've been doing and you want to know how to do it, just feel free to text me or give me a call and let's talk about it, because I want you to be able to do this. I want you to be able to do this well and right. Wayne is asking me, can pruned offshoots on a magnolia be treated with triclopyr 4 or will it damage the mother tree? No! No. No. Don't do that. That would be a bad thing to do. It will definitely damage the mother tree. That's now how much it will damage the mother tree, I can't tell you. It's going to be hard to know, but that is just the perfect way to apply triclopyr to control or even damage a mother tree by just cutting off the sprouts around the base and then putting, ooh, no, don't do that. It definitely will circulate into the mother tree. It will not be good for the mother tree at all. And you're not going to control the sprouting. In fact, you might, it's theoretically possible you could actually increase sprouting by doing that. You're just going to have to prune those sprouts off. So do not use a herbicide on the sprouts. There's nothing that you could have. There's some hormone things that you can use to, but none of that's going to work for you. Just prune it off. I wouldn't look for a shortcut there. Is it okay to prune back two or three of the older trucks on my blueberries at this time? Yes, it is. It's just fine. You're not going to prune the new growth. You need to be thinned out. And it doesn't hurt to, if you want to just do one now and one in spring and then one next year, you can do that. This is not a bad time of year for pruning. Even apples and even persimmons and even a lot of other plants that are getting a little bit rangy, peaches, it's not a bad time to come back and start pruning just a little bit and thinning and doing some more pruning. We can talk more about that. Yeah, not this morning. I think that could take a while. But, yeah, I think it's okay to prune back. What you're doing with the blueberry, you're going to prune back, and I would go ahead, take them as deep into the as with blueberries when you prune, take them as deep back into the crown as possible. Just get rid of that heavy brown wood all the way down. And if it happens, just do it as deep as possible. in general, it's probably better to go back to about 6 inches above the ground. On just two or three of the heaviest sprouts on the interior of the plant. And just do it a little bit at a time. You don't have to rush it. Just any little bit that you do now, and then come back in spring and do it a little more. B-Dark says, one thing I learned about gardening is you got to get off your butt and do it. Don't do it itself. Ooh, B-Dark, I got to be careful about reading your stuff out loud. But that's okay. I think we can say that word out loud. It don't do it itself. Yeah, there it is. I think that is a wise advice. Just get off your hoot nanny and do it. Right? And that's what I encourage y'all to do it with the seedlings. And B-Dark's just done a beautiful job. Spiders and snakes are underrated, and Jim has a beautiful picture of what looks like an Argiopa garden spider. Oh, it is. I can see the zigzag. See the zigzag in the web? It sent me a beautiful picture. Jim, and just a great picture of those spiders. I've got a good spider story, but I don't know if I can tell it out loud. It's really funny. Snakes and spiders, to get back to this, snakes and spiders are always credited with things that they didn't do. And it's sort of this religious thing. It's hard to explain. It's like what we've been taught. And, will a black widow kill you? No. Will a brown recluse kill you? No. Will it cause a skin issue? Sometimes not. I used to believe that spiders bit a lot more until I talked to some spider experts who I made a claim about, and they said, nah. Because most spiders don't bite, and in fact, I've had spiders all over me. Now, I do think garden spiders do bite, but it's pretty rare, and it doesn't do a lot of damage, and it goes away pretty quick. It's not going to be like even a wasp sting, and I think there are probably even fewer allergic reactions. We'll get into spiders another day. There's great spider stories, and we'll tell them. I'll come back to them. But today we're on this thing called snakes, because you're going to be seeing a lot more of them. And I want to talk just a little bit about them to help you distinguish what you've got. Most of the snakes that you see in your yard are probably going to be hugely beneficial to you. I like those little brown snakes that everybody has in their yard. And I had a contractor one time. I was out as in Midtown. We got so many brown snakes in Midtown. It's unbelievable. They're everywhere. If you've got a yard in Midtown and you don't see a brown snake, you're not looking. And they're not big. They're 12 inches, 10 inches, 12 inches, 8, 10, 12, maybe 18 inches is a big one. I saw one the other day. It's maybe getting close to 18 inches. It's big for a brown snake, but they don't get that big that often. They're pretty small, and they have little bitty tiny heads. Little tiny heads. Their heads aren't even much bigger than their bodies. And that's a pretty good clue when you're looking at these brown snakes that they have a hard time biting you. And they don't really. They're really going after little invertebrates. They're probably eating roly-polies. Probably eating roly-polies. Probably eating snails and slugs and stuff like that in the garden. They don't have a huge metabolism. I don't know that they're going to clean out your roly-polies. They're not going to clean out your snails and slugs. But on the net, they're probably pretty good for you. We can come back and describe how to discern a brown snake here in just a minute. And I'm going to tell you about the ground rattler story. And then Sean's got some stuff. I got to run. I got to answer some questions for Sean. We'll be back. I decline, I ain't gonna pick no peas.
Because everything doing the... Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106. on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, all right, welcome back. A lot of things we've got to address here. So I'm going to come back, Sean. Sean wants me to talk about blackberry pruning, and we're going to do that after 10:30. We're going to, in that next segment, we're going to talk a little bit about blackberry pruning. It's an okay time of year to do it. Probably not the best time of year to do it, but I think you'll probably still be okay. We'll come back. Let's just talk about that later. But meanwhile, we do have some great pictures of snakes that have been sent to us. A beautiful, one of the most beautiful of all snakes, a diamondback, which some of us don't get to see every day. I don't get to see diamondbacks anymore, and I regret that because I think they're beautiful snakes. And they're just, they're like timber rattlers, which I see all the time now, in that they're all around you, and you probably don't know it if you're in the woods, because they really don't want to be seen. And oftentimes, unless they're way out in the open, and they're probably not even going to rattle. There's a theory that rattlesnakes, and I'm not sure it's true, but it was often expressed that maybe rattlers don't rattle as much as they used to because we've selected for rattlers that don't rattle. Because if they rattle and people know where they are, they go take the hoe or the shotgun and they shoot them. And so the ones that survive are the ones that don't rattle. And so we're selecting for rattleless rattlers. Could be true. I don't know if we're making that much of a dent on the remaining population, or if in areas where probably more than likely you're seeing a lot of hoe killing and shotgunning, there probably just aren't any rattlers left at all, so they're not adapting. So I'm not sure I think that's true. But the fact of the matter is many rattlers don't rattle when you go by them. How do you tell? There is something. So let's start with the stuff that where we should start. In the suburbs, in where many of you live, and where there's kind of houses have been there for a while, you're probably not going to see many poisonous snake because we've killed them all. One poisonous snake, I guarantee you will never see. And everybody talks about it, and they all give the little rhyme about red on yellow and red on black and all that kind of stuff. Don't even worry about that. You're never going to see a coral snake. You're just not going to see it. In fact, if you see a coral snake, you need to let me know right away, because coral snakes haven't been recorded in Alabama, particularly in South Alabama, where they used to be probably moderately common, but pretty fossorial. That is, they hid out under logs and in the underground, and you didn't see them very often. But they just haven't even been recorded in South Alabama in decades. We don't even know if they still exist here. It's scary. It's really weird. But you're not going to see coral snakes, so don't even worry about coral snakes. Don't worry about remembering red on yellow, kill a fella. That's ridiculous. Don't worry about it. It's just not going to happen. Not knowledge you'll ever need. But you will see copperheads. You will see one of three kinds of rattlesnakes, and cotton mouse, which in the old days, water moccasin and cotton mouse was not an equivalent term. Water moccasin just referred to any snake that was in the water. But a cotton mouth, water moccasin, whatever you want to call it, those are three poisonous snakes. Most water snakes are not poisonous, and most snakes people see in the water are not poisonous. Just by the way, while we're there. But in the suburbs, you're going to see mostly non-poisonous snakes. And one of the most common ones is going to be the brown snake. Midland brown snake. There are various names. There are various populations, but they're brown snake. Storaria is the Latin name. And they're little bitty snakes. They have little patchy markings on them that are kind of cute. It's like a checkerboard. So you'll see one. It's got a little checkerboard. It has a little tiny head. It's got a little bit of black on the head. Little tiny head, not any bigger than the body. And they're all over the place. And they have a checkerboard pattern. If you can see these snakes, if the snake's head isn't bigger than the body, you don't need to worry about it. You just don't need to worry about it. And most what people are seeing and calling ground rattlers, oh heavens to Betsy, are in fact these harmless brown snakes. And you can look at them on the internet, you can look, give it a little better look, but just don't sweat it. You may have garter snakes. I think they're less common. You may see a green snake, which are extremely beautiful. Just unbelievable creatures. I love that green. I love that. It's just, they really are incredibly beautiful. It's like you could almost decorate your house with them. They're just so beautiful. But those are the kinds of snakes you're going to see in your yard, and they're not harmful. You might see a rat snake. But let me tell you, if the head is smaller than the body, let's get back to this. If the head is the same size as the body or smaller than the body, it's just not going to be poisonous. A poisonous snake in Alabama, the head is going to flare out noticeably wider than the body. There are a few snakes that have wider the heads that are almost as wide as their body, and sometimes they puff up, but in normal circumstances, the head is going to be the same width as the body. That's the first good clue. One quick thing to look at. And with things like brown snakes, the head is so much smaller than the body, you almost can't tell which end is the head and which end is the tail. Because they're really small heads. The other thing is, the pupils of snakes, all of the poisonous snakes that you're going to encounter in Alabama that are native are going to have cat eyes. They're going to have slit eyes. They're going to have they're not going to have a round pupil. They're going to have a cat pupil. There you go. And most of the snakes that you see in Alabama that are venomous, poisonous, I don't care what you say, don't get all hung up on it. Most of them are going to have hoods over their eyes to some degree. Their eyes are not going to just be flat on their heads. They're going to have a hood over their eyes. It's really kind of distinctive. All that's good. But they'll get hung up. And if somebody says, oh my gosh, that's a ground rattler. Well, just know that ground rattler is a term in Alabama that's used about like, it's just used indiscriminately. It doesn't. In fact, if anybody uses the word ground rattler, more than likely, it is a very excellent indication that they have no clue what they're talking about. Because nobody who has any knowledge of snake is probably ever going to use the term ground rattler at all. So just ignore it if somebody says it was a contractor. Who was gonna, we had so many in our yard. And he just was freaked out. He was gonna stop work. Oh, Lord have mercy. He's gonna stop work because there was a ground rattler. Had to clear all the ground. I went over and I said, where's this ground rattler? And I went over and it was a brown snake. I mean, they were all over the yard. Harmless. So I started picking up and playing with them, letting them crawl all over my hands. And it was like, I don't know. It's like a religious experience for him. And I would recommend, here's what I would recommend. There's all these churches that are handling snakes. Go get some brown snakes. Call them ground rattlers and do them so you won't get bit and die. Isn't that a good idea? Find the biggest brown snake you can. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, so we're going to... President Barnes had a belly full of cotton rat. I'm just looking at... I'm getting lots of snake pictures. Great looking rat snake, corn snake. Is that maybe a corn snake? Bet you won't handle this one. Yeah, you know, I don't handle poison snakes. I just think, oh gosh, why bother? I know people who do, but a lot of people who do, but you know, people who handle snakes in church and herpetologists are among the most likely, are people who keep snakes for pets are the most likely people to get bit. Don't do it. Did a lot of things about cottonmouths and the cottonmouth smell. I think they do. They emit a musk, and a lot of snakes will emit a musk. It's described as various things. I don't think it smells like cucumbers, which I hear people say. There is a peculiar smell that a lot of snakes have. I know because they've wiped it on my hands before when I picked them up. And a lot of times it's a combination of musk and, you know, poop. And it can happen. Maybe that's a reason you don't want to pick up snakes. It's because you get that musky smell on you. It's not a terrible thing. It's kind of an interesting smell. And it, sometimes you can tell it, but I wouldn't use it to discern whether the snake was nearby. Any rate, snakes. But I did say that I was going to answer Sean's questions, and we got some questions about pruning. Let's go to the we have a caller, and I'm going to go to our caller first, Sean, and then I'm going to come try to get back to your blackberries as in the same discussion. Okay, who's our caller again? Phil? Steve? Hey, Mark. Good.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
Well, I'm doing great. I appreciate you taking my call.
Yes, sir.
My question is, I have a peach tree and a plum tree. They're about 20 foot tall. And last year, they didn't make anything. And the previous 2 years, they just loaded up so much. It was just unreal. And I don't know how to prune them, when to prune them. If I had someone that could show me, and I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah. So here it is. So they're pretty big now, and they're going to be really hard to deal with. I wouldn't mess with success. You could try to get them down to small size, And if you do, you're going to weaken them considerably at this point. You're not a commercial grower. I would not spend a lot of time pruning. How is that? Here's what I would do. You can certainly go in this time of year, and it's an okay time of year to do it, and look for limbs that are growing towards the interior of the tree. And if you see what I'm saying, some branches will produce limbs that grow back towards the trunk or towards the interior, more or less. And those branches, just go ahead and remove them. Those are really easy, and that will allow more air circulation without doing a lot of damage to the tree.
Yeah, because it looks like the center of the tree has it's big by itself, just the center of the tree growing up. And I was told one time by the internet to take out the center and only leave the outside.
Right. You're way beyond that now.
Okay. Yeah.
And there are advantages to doing that, which means that the tree is easier to pick. But peaches and plums are both very sensitive in this climate. And you just don't want to, you don't want to tamper with it. If you're getting any production at all, you're doing better than most folks.
Well, this past year, I did not get anything, but the previous 2 years, man, yeah.
We're going to come to that. Let's stick with the pruning for just a second, and then I'm going to come back and tell you why. So you want to get those interior limbs, and then if you can, if you like, just to make it easier to pick, if it's still growing pretty vigorously at the top, if you've got a long shoot coming straight up at the top, you can prune that shoot back to the next, to the limb below it. To the next, to the limb below it. Let's say prune it back to a limb that's about the size of your thumb, maybe a little smaller. And just prune it back, and that'll lower the height just a little bit. And then that limb that you left at the top, every year go in and prune it back to the next lowest limb, and that will help to keep it a little lower. But you're not going to want to do a lot of really aggressive pruning on that tree right now because it's just too mature, and you're not going to get it back. Mature. You're not going to get back to that open center that you see people talking about on the internet. And so don't talk to some dude on the internet who basically is talking to some other dude on the internet, who talked to another dude on the internet, who talked to another dude on the internet who said you ought to prune this way. So just don't pay any attention. Your trees are too big.
And they're beautiful, man. They're beautiful.
Yeah. And so don't mess with it. Now, let's come back to what you can do. So interior limbs, go in there and work on those. And you can send me some pictures of limbs if you have any questions about it next week, and we'll talk about it. Or maybe we won't be here next week, but depending on the holiday. But send me a picture when we're back live, and we can look at that, and we can decide. And this is not a bad time to do it. You can do it now. But there are a couple of reasons. When you have really big years, when you're loaded up with plums and peaches, you can exhaust the tree. And the year after that, that's one reason, you may have very few fruits that next year. And it's quite likely that those 2 years of high production would have reduced the percentage of fruiting that you would get because the tree's basically exhausted. Have you ever fertilized these trees?
Yeah, I had I put a triple 10 out around them.
Did I lose you?
No, sir. I'm here.
Okay, you put triple 10 out. How long? How many? Yes, when did you do that this year?
Well, I do it every year. I do it a couple times a year. I'll do it right before they start to bloom.
Yeah.
And then I go out to the drip line of the tree and I do that. And I also basically do it from the drip line back to the tree. To be honest with you, I just do the whole thing.
Yeah. And no need to over fertilize them. So you're getting plenty of fertilizer. So that's not an issue. Your trees are healthy. I would say you probably don't need triple 10. You probably need something that's like, if you can find a fertilizer with a low middle number, that would be preferable. So like 10-5-10 or 10-10-0-5. Something like that, or 20, 25, 10. You see that middle number is lower?
Yeah, make sure that middle number is low.
Make sure the middle number is lower. You're fertilizing it plenty, so that's not an issue at all. So we don't have to worry about that. So here's the other thing that can have an effect, two other things that can have an effect that you need to think about. One is late frost. And we're having more late frost. So, and plus the winters have been warmer and winter starts up and then we get a late frost. This is one of the, because, you know, we got all these monitors out there who are telling on you. We call it changes in the weather, changes in the seasons. Some people might call it climate change. It's what's happening. And so we're getting warmer winter nights. It's clear. It's absolutely clear that winters are warming up more at night. And what that means is, on most nights, and what that means is that the trees are emerging sooner, they're flowering sooner, and then you get a late frost, which comes at a normal time, or even sometimes a little later, and boom, you lose your flowers. That may have happened to your, that may have happened to your trees this year. So, yeah, we've seen a lot of loss with that. In fact, in Chilton County, it's getting to be so bad that farmers there don't know what to do because of these late frost and the early leaf out and early flowering because of warm weather during winter. So it's like a double whammy. So that's a problem too. More than likely, since your tree has produced well in the past, it's quite likely that it may produce well again in the future. When it does, it's probably going to produce a ton of fruit. So I'm going to tell you another kind of pruning you should do. Thin the fruits so that each fruit, as many fruits as possible, are 6 inches apart. Okay. And that way it won't stress the tree so bad. The remaining fruits will get a little bigger. And you won't have that alternate bearing problem where it fruits really well one year and then doesn't fruit well the next year. That's going to be a little harder to do with the plums because there's going to be so many plums, but I would at least do it with the peaches.
Well, one thing about that peach tree is this year, all year long, it has just been dropping yellow leaves. I mean, through the whole year.
Okay. Dropping yellow leaves. Well,
yeah.
I don't know what that means. Is there?
I don't know either.
So, I mean, trees frequently shed leaves.
Yeah.
But it's still got a plenty of healthy leaves on it.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Don't worry about it. Okay. Not a worry. It's probably it just means that it's replacing older leaves with newer leaves, and you know, in some years that'll happen when it's not getting a lot of stress and when it's growing vigorously, that'll happen. And I wouldn't worry too much about that. I don't think it's significant.
Now, I want to ask you something. When you want some pictures of the trees, and do you want me to text them to this phone number I'm calling you
on?
Yeah,
you can text them to this phone number. And, I'm happy to look at pictures of the trees. You can text them to this phone number. If you have any questions about pruning, and I've told you to do something very simple, which is just to prune those interior limbs. I wouldn't do a whole lot more.
Right, just prune everything, just turn it to the inside.
Turn it to the inside. That'll clean it out a lot and go from there. But if you have any questions about that, send me a picture and we'll look at it here in a couple of weeks. Okay?
Okay, Bill, I really appreciate you, man. I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
All right, sounds good. Thanks.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Yeah, so now we got to answer Sean's question. And it's a good question about pruning blackberries. We kind of gone through it before. You can get really fussy about, you can look at all these things on there, on the internet, you know, where one person took advice from another person who took advice from another person who took advice from another person on the internet. Let me just say, let's keep it simple with blackberries. You're not going to get a good double harvest of blackberries. So there are some systems out there where you're going to double. Don't mess with that. You're not. It's just not going to work. Here's the other problem with blackberries that we want to think about. So you're going to get one good harvest of blackberries. That's all you want to do. That's all you need to do. There's another thing to think about blackberries, and that is that they are disease magnets. And I almost am tempted to say, just burn the things. And they're going to resprout, and I think you could probably do that. But let's don't do that. Here's what I'm going to suggest. I think maybe the ideal situation is, as soon as you pick the blackberries, mow them to the ground. This is ideal. I'm telling you, Sean, this is the ideal way. Mow them to the ground a few weeks after you pick the blackberries. Get rid of all of those stems and all of those leaves. Just pull them out. Rake them out of the bed. You'll get lots of green growth. You can put leaves or something else there if you want. That's probably not a bad idea, but not blackberry leaves, oak leaves or something else. And that lessens the chance. And take those leaves that you did get from the blackberries and put them on the other side of the property or burn them or whatever. But don't leave them next to the blackberries so that you don't get any overwintering diseases. Put a good mulch on there from leaves or other things. Now, that's ideal. That's how I would do it. You can, and the only other thing I would do, because blackberries are going to fruit on lateral canes that basically form in that second winter, in the second spring. Well, in when spring occurs, excuse me. Not this year, but the next year, they're going to produce on those floor canes. They're going to produce. But here's what you can do later in summer, if you do it ideally, is you can just go in and cut the tops off. Cut the tops of those blackberries about 3 months after you cut them back. Just cut the tops of everything back to about chest high. Boom. And then let it go. That's the way I would treat cultivated blackberries. You're pruning, you're doing it late in the year, but you also are in a long season area. I think you'll probably be fine. So here's what I would do. I would go ahead and mow them down. I don't think it's the perfect time, but it's probably an okay time. And if you leave all that tangle, it's just going to be a mess. And you don't want to get in there and have to pick each through each stem. You just don't want to do it. Just mow the whole thing down. You're still going to get a lot of canes coming up that first year. You probably don't need to pinch them back. They'll probably be okay. You can pinch them back in, say, October. If you get a lot of growth, you can cut them back just a little bit, pinch them back a little bit at the top. How's that? Is that okay? That's what I would do. And then those should fruit very well next year. Some people mow them. I will say that some people simply mow them in late fall or winter. And you can certainly do that. I do think you're probably going to lose a little bit of your harvest if you do that. I would mow them down a little bit earlier. And I'm not going to tell you to go in and select each individual cane and decide which one. No, just don't do that, because you don't want to get two harvests out of this. It's too hard. All right. Does that help? Just cut them down. After the blackberry discussion, a short dissertation on blueberry pruning, addressing the tall shoots when to fertilize. Thanks, Jimmy. Jim, blueberries. Look, folks, we went through this. Here's the simple thing on blueberries. Blueberries don't need a lot of pruning until they get about 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. Don't worry about pruning young blueberries. You may need to thin the fruits on them, but don't worry about pruning them. After some year, around 5, 6, 7 years, you're going to get some really thick canes that are less productive. Each year, go in and prune out the thickest of those canes, starting around year 7. But, you know, just don't get too aggressive. Don't start too early. And once a year, one stem per year, and prune it all the way to the ground. Or as close to the ground as you can get it. Don't prune it waist high. Don't prune it chest high. I'm talking about pruning it down to about shin high or ankle high, so that you can get younger sprouts coming up. And you'll do that once. You may not even need to do it once every year. It's just not frequent. Do not prune the tops of your blueberries. You're going to make a huge mistake if you do that. Don't do it. Prune down to the base. It's very simple. It's very simple. And what's even more simple is you could probably not prune your blueberry and it would still do okay for a long, long time. But it's those thicker canes that actually get to be more difficult to pick because they're going to be taller. And they're also going to be less productive as time goes on. So it's pruning out those big canes about year 5 or 7. There it is. So how did we start this discussion? We started this discussion with snakes. You know, it's funny. I don't know why we react to snakes the way we do. It's entirely a learned thing. We're in the woods with snakes all the time at the research center. We give them names. We walk around them. We step over them. We don't mean to. We have this thing called the Tree of Paradise, which is a persimmon, which has unusually large fruits. It's a native persimmon by a spring. It's clear that animal life walks by there all the time. We decided to set up cameras and we were running around. There were 4 of us setting up cameras. There were 2 dogs. We were running all over the place under this persimmon, picking up persimmons under the tree until somebody said, "Whoa." And right there under the tree, we had stepped over it probably, 20, 30 times. It was a big timber rattler just saying, "Oh my gosh," the timber rattler is saying, "why don't these people leave us alone?" Never bit one of us, never even tried. Just sat there quietly. And I can't tell you how often that's happened. Just a thought. Bartram said, "They're generous, they're magnanimous, the rattlers." We'll be back